We're back and call it 20, so we're a little early getting to Sean Clancy. We'll get to Sean here momentarily, as soon as he's ready. And we'll talk about Percy Warner. And I actually have not. I should really go to their website and see where they stand for Saturday for the Iroquois. And how many, how many people can go? Well, it says get tickets, so I guess they're all right. By attending the 2021 Iroquois Steeplechase, ticket holders agree that they are attending by their own will and understand the inherent risk of exposure to COVID that exists in any public place where people are present. So it feels like it's a personal responsibility scenario this weekend in Nashville, and this is one of the really special events. And I suppose one question too that would need answering is considering that this is usually run the second Saturday in May between Derby and Preakness. So I am curious how how temperate. It could reach 91. So it's going to be nice enough, though. No rain. Doesn't look like through Saturday in and around Nashville. So should be all right. And no rain today or tomorrow either. Just low percentage chances. So it looks like they'll be pretty firm going. And I've been looking forward to the abuse I'm going to take from Sean for weeks, ever since it became clear that Tina and I could not make this trip. it's a race with the Temple Gwathmey winner, Snap Decision, and I suppose Snap Decision and Galway Kid, coming off the Sims win in Virginia for Kerry Brion, probably the two major principles. You do have, you got actually the Sims, the horse that was third in the Sims too, beaten a half length, Bedrock for Mr. Naylor and Cyril Murphy. Those are the three principles, but Sean has got some interests on the day, and a couple of the other the nice $50,000 stake, the Green Pastures. He's got City Dreamer, so we're looking forward to hearing about Sean's action. I think he's got a maiden too. There's a couple of maiden races, and they got a nice card. So, you know what's fun? What's great about, and for those that I keep trying to get you to, take an interest on the chase side, and maybe one of the ways we can do that is to, is to alert you to certain horses that that are moving into the jumping game, and one of them that you're certainly going to know. Oh, Dionysus makes his debut over the jumps Saturday. That's in a maiden, the third, going 2.25 mile. How old is he now? Seven. $450,000 in earnings, seven-time winner on the flat, and it was a nice 3-year-old, and then stayed on and kept competing at a high level. But it seemed last year that kind of things were winding down. And I hear Sean Clancy in the background. Sean, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. I was just telling people, I'm trying to think every which way to get them interested in the jump game. And so I was telling them that, oh, Dionysus is making the transition over to the jumps and goes for a jump graduation tomorrow or Saturday in the third at Percy Warner. But let's, before we dive into the card, I'll turn the floor over to you, and you can admonish me for not being able to get to the Iroquois this year.
That's news. I mean, I thought for sure you're going to be there. What are you talking about?
You say it every
time. Come on, man. It's usually the great thing. I mean, this year's, I've been on the road. I've got to go to the Derby and then the Preakness. And now it's June. I mean, there's nothing going on. Where are you going to be Saturday?
Tina's goddaughter has her baby shower.
What was she thinking? Didn't she know? She didn't get the memo?
This is like people when they schedule a wedding on Travers weekend. Exactly. There's been tons of that.
Exactly. You got to remember, I'm the guy who skipped my sister's wedding to ride two races at Fairfax Hunt Meet in the second Saturday in September. So that went over big. I'm in the Clancy family.
Unbelievable! How long did it take to live that down?
I'm still trying, right? I'll let you know. And I'll tell you, I mean, I was 24, I guess, and really, I hate to say it, but, I mean, I was so narrow-minded and focused on what I was doing. My only regret was that I didn't win a race. I mean, I just went down there and I had 2 fourths, and I thought, oh, God, if I could have won a race, this would have justified it, but... Since I just, mustered 2 fourths, I probably should have gone to the wedding, I guess. Nice, huh?
That's so great.
My sister Sheila is out there listening. Sorry, love. I tell you that all the time.
Well, have you had chances to make it up with the nephews and nieces or anything?
They actually had me down there when they had two infants, and her husband Brian had to get back surgery. So I went for the weekend to watch these two kids, and I'd never really been around kids like that. And I was greeted with the dirty diaper up the back on my hand, and I thought, So she got back pretty good there.
That's great. Well, I feel terrible, and I commit that at some point, now we'll shoot for next year.
Come on, tomorrow never comes, buddy.
Here's my excuse. I want to go when it's in its traditional spot.
Okay, we'll make it happen.
Before we dive in, and you've got some interest. You've got a stake runner. You've got a maiden, I think, looking to break through as well Saturday. But a little bit from last week, at least, I think, haven't looked at the results from Tryon a couple of weeks ago we get ready for the racetrack side of chasing, did you have any interest in there?
No, I actually didn't run anything at Tryon. It was just kind of a long ship. I actually just didn't have much to go there, so I was kind of waiting for. I've got a couple to go to Nashville and several to go to Saratoga, so hopefully we can regroup and fire away this summer.
Well, I talked to Joe after the Virginia Gold Cup and Winter and. Just looking at those quick results, what did we get? We had Neil Morris and Vincent Van Gogh win a maiden claimer, and you had Kerry Brion, who's really peppering the entry box, and she won one for Mr. Naylor, maiden as well. You had Leslie Young win, so things were spread around a little bit. Arch won another one on the flat, and Allison Fulmer, the Happy Giant, won the Blockhouse, the nominal feature as well.
Yeah, that was a cool. Allison Fulmer is just she does it all herself, owns and trains the horse, and that's actually New York bred. And put Mel Boucher, that was just her second win of her career, the jockey, So that was cool. That was a good result for that. And he's a neat horse, actually.
Well, we turn our attention to Saturday, and let's start with the feature, and then we'll talk about what really is a terrific card. And I see that they're letting people come completely on, you know, they've got their own personal responsibility, but I imagine there'll be a nice crowd at Percy Warner Saturday.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good crowd. It sounds like everything's open down there. I know they had some reaction. You know, I think people, unlike you, who make, you know, Iroquois their destination every year, but they had some people that, you know, couldn't come in June because they have things, you know, the last Saturday in June, they have things they do on the last Saturday in June. And so I think that's been a little bit different for people. You know, they traditionally mark off the calendar, okay, second Saturday in May, I'll be at the Iroquois, you know, a lot of the locals down there. So I know, I think a lot of the, not a lot, but I'm sure some of those diehards aren't going to be there this year because of that. But I think it'll be a big crowd. It's a festive event. It's a complete one-off place. I mean, everybody comes out, the crowd's raucous, and they love to see the horses. And Nashville, the Iroquois course itself, it's a mile and a half around, so it's like the Belmont Park of steeplechase courses. And big amphitheater, kind of a natural amphitheater. You stand up on the hillside and see the whole course. So it's an iconic place for sure.
Well, you got some familiar names competing in here too, and got the first important Grade One of the season, and Temple Gwathmey winner, Snap Decision, Jack Fisher. I imagine is, you know, really where we start here, and you've also got some horses, in fact, that you ran against with Jim Raffaro in the Sims. That are our major players, Galway Kid, right, and Bedrock. It seems like the three principals.
For sure. I mean, the race starts and centers and finishes around Snap Decision. He's, Phipps bred son of Hard Spun out of Salute, who everybody would know. He's won nine in
eight
a row,
straight,
I guess,
yeah.
Or eight in a row, I guess, yep. At this stage. I've already given him this one. So he's won eight in a row. He's done it all. He's versatile. He can handle the racetrack, the speed of Saratoga. He can handle the distance of 2.5 miles at the Hunt Meet at Far Hills. I mean, it's hard to find any chink in his armor. I mean, he's just, he can sit close. He can come from out of it. He carries weight. He's relatively young in our sport. He's a 7-year-old. His Temple Gwathmey was just with utter ease. I mean, he just galloped around there. I mean, it's just complete domination of that group. 1 by 9 on the bridle. Graham Waters is riding great. He's got Jack Fisher in his corner. They've shortened the Iroquois this year to 2 3/4 miles. It's always been a 3-mile race. They shortened it a bit, mostly because it's summer and the heat down there. And so that, you know, he's never been 3 miles. So you could maybe say, okay, that's going to be the question. Can he go 3 miles? But it's shortened up to 2 3/4. He's never gone that far, but he's handled 2.5, like I said, at Far Hills. So, and again, in the Temple Gwathmey, he's 2.5. So really cool horse, tough. So he's the horse to beat, obviously. Beyond him, Bedrock's an interesting horse. He had some good form in Ireland back in 2018. Came here with a big reputation and really did not perform in two starts for Leslie Young way back in 2019. And resurfaced with Cyril Murphy this in the Sims and actually ran very well. We just got beat half a length to Galway Kid. So he might improve off of that. He's not really a 2 3/4 mile horse. He's unproven at that. He's more of a 2-mile horse in Ireland. But, he's an interesting horse because he's kind of got a back class and a nice horse. Galway Kid's tough, won the Sims, kind of bounced back from, he's way too far in front of the Temple Gwathmey, so came back and Bernie Dalton settled him, and he ran well. Footpad's another, name horse, same thing, came here with a big reputation, on the Arkle at Cheltenham in 2018 for Willie Mullins and Ruby Walsh, and he was really compromised by COVID, missed all of 2020, just because there weren't races for him. You know, he's kind of missed the spring, and then Saratoga didn't suit, and then there weren't any stakes in the fall. So he missed his really a crucial year of his eight-year-old season. So now he's nine, ran okay in the Temple Grandin. He finished fourth, beaten a long way, but was out the back, never really traveled very well. Would probably benefit with a little bit of a cut in the ground. I don't really know. I'll look and see how much water they put on this course, but those are probably the principles. New members, cool. Veteran coming back. Sportswear is capable against novices, but it's unproven at this level. And Hamshell is the other one, reserve nailer horse, who actually ran pretty well in the Temple Grandin. He finished third. Definitely a 2 3/4 mile horse, where Bedrock's more of a 2 mile horse. Hamshell certainly more of a 2 3/4 mile horse, but yet to beat this kind, the likes of Snap Decision.
Well, and Jack Fisher obviously already, pacing the trainer standings and wins. I mean, he's sent out more than anybody, but actually the wins, looking at that portion of things, the wins actually have been spread around pretty good. I'm just noting Kath Nielsen, Jack's got 6, Nielsen's got 5, Mark Beecher's got 4, Leslie Young's got 4, Neil Morris 3, and it seems like everybody's sharing the wealth a little bit here as we reach the midpoint of the calendar.
Yeah, it certainly is that. But because of the schedule and because we're still dealing with the ramifications of COVID with purse structure, so there's been a lot of smaller races, kind of lesser races, and that kind of helped the little guy with their kind of horses. I mean, a lot of those guys maiden claimers and ratings races and some apprentice races, and Kathy's won. I know she's won a couple apprentice races with her daughter Skylar McKenna, and Mark Beecher's won some timber races, and it's been spread around that way. Jack Fisher's got a very high-end kind of stable where he doesn't have probably the arsenal to compete at that, in the smaller races. So that's certainly added to that. And Jack's at 11 seconds this year, which is hard to believe. That's 6 wins in 11 seconds. So, it's fun, though. It's good. It's good to spread out, and, more people are winning, and Jack might not feel that way, but certainly the rest of the trainers feel like they're winning, which is, nice. You got to spread it out.
Well, look through the card beyond the feature, and the Iroquois goes off at 4:30 Central, so 5:30 Eastern on what'll be a nice active Saturday of racing around the country, and you can watch everything at the National Steeplechase .com website. They've got the stream, and talk a little bit, Sean, about your interest. Let's look at the Green Pastures, for instance, where City Dreamer coming back for the second start of the season, the 7-year-old.
Yeah, he's an interesting horse. He's been a fun horse for us. He's still in the novice condition, which is kind of your good news, bad news. It's it's good news that you still have that condition. It's bad news that you haven't lost that condition. He won the novice stake. It was then called the Marcellus Frost back in 2019. So he won that over the same course. That's really his only win in this country. But he's picked up a check pretty much every time he's run for us, except once when a saddle slipped. So neat horse. I don't know if he really relished the ground at Queen's Cup. It was a little bit soft. I got too far out of it just by circumstance more than anything. So I'm hoping he'll run well. It's a competitive race. There's no real standouts. I mean, our novice condition is really for horses that it's really a non-winners of 3 races other than 3-year-old or a date kind of race. So new kind of younger horses that are novices in our sport. So it's always a very competitive division. This got a big field, 12 horses. You've got maiden winners like Perfect Tapatino. It was pretty impressive, I thought, at the Gold Cup for Leslie Young, son of Perfect Soul. Neat horse. He's probably alive in there. Kill Ronan's a nice horse. Had some bad luck. Almost fell over. Horse fell in front of him at Camden. So that's where see that pulled up on his line. But he was impressive at Queen's Cup before that. Big galloping type horse. Needs to kind of work out a trip probably in this group. Waterborne Bucko for Kerry is a nice horse. Won twice last year. Spent the winter in Ireland. Actually ran a couple of good races early and then tailed off. So really, any horse in a race could win it. Content is not bad. There's just has some back class in England. Fast Car is a nice horse for Robert LaPenta. Won at Saratoga last year. Makes his first start for Jack Fisher. Chief Justice has some class. Was right there with City Dreamer 2 years ago in this race. So it's a cool race. Tough race. Like I said, anybody could win it.
It's a nice group, and turn and look at the maiden races as well, and we'll talk about Queen's Empire in a second that is going to make a jump debut. But I, as we were waiting for you to join us, I talked about O Dionysus for now Cyril Murphy over the jumps. And Mr. Naylor, this is a horse, you know, we talked during its flat career many times, and you know, made almost a half a million through age six, and now is going to try to transition. And I think I've asked you this in one guise or another, but you know, how do you? We can't bet on this. I mean, let's pretend for a second that it was at Saratoga. How would you know what to expect from a horse like this that obviously can make distance races? That's not necessarily an issue. This is 2.25 miles, and the horse that had competed a mile and a half, mile and three eighths, and so forth. But you know, how do you evaluate whether a horse like this is going to be successful jumping?
It's hard to make a blanket statement because it's really up to the horse whether they will take to it. I mean, like sometimes older horses just have had such hard, not hard miles, but they've had that routine of flat racing, and sometimes they don't really adapt to jump racing where you got to settle and gallop and stay off the bridle, and you know, sometimes they're a little bit set in their ways. So you'd be surprised that it's more difficult, especially as they get older. I mean, like this horse, O Dionysus, he's ran through his 5-year-old year as a flat horse with Gary Capuano, then Ciro bought him in the Fasey Tipton horse and training part of Timonium sale. And he just ran him on the flat last year, which reading between the lines, you'd say, okay, he probably needed more time to school and adapt and get the hang of it because he skipped all, you know, he did not make his make a start over hurdles last year. COVID partly do that too, but so you'd reading between the lines, you'd say, okay, maybe he just needed more time to adapt to it and kind of get the hang of it. Lovely horse, got plenty of class. He's just got to settle and make that adjustment to jump racing, and if he does, he's by far the class of the race. But that's a big if. I mean, especially like if you look at a horse like Snap Decision, you know, you can buy a 4-year-old. You know, they bought him as a 4-year-old end of 2018. So, you know, he just was able to adjust to our game pretty quickly. Where O Dionysus is a 6-year-old when they bought him, so it's just or five, I guess, but you know, had him for a 6-year-old year. But so sometimes it's a little bit, just takes a little longer, whether they can adapt. But lovely horse, it's a pretty wide open race. I mean, for the Nashville has always been, it's really always been the best maiden race of the year when it's in May. So this year they split it, two divisions, 8 horses in each, and it's actually not as not as deep as previous years. I mean, you look back at Goodnight Shirt broke his maiden there. Snap Decision ran in the maiden there. So it usually attracts serious horses, and it's got some good horses in here this year, but probably not as deep as other years.
And it's intriguing too for those, and we, you know, when we handicap races, and when Bill Gallo and I will go through, and I always tell people that during the Saratoga season, a horse like this that was recording 90 buyers, and even last year when he really was distanced a couple of times in the United Nations and in the dinner party at Pimlico in October, is still recorded, you know, 70s, 80s buyers. A horse that was this fast on the flat is, if they're adept at all at jumping, they're going to excel at the racetrack. And, you know, one thing, even though the buyers on the flat, you know, don't necessarily equate to the jumping ability, obviously, the speed at the flat track at Saratoga and this summer at Colonial, and when races are run at Belmont or Delaware and Monmouth, etc. Horses that were fast as just turf thoroughbreds, they do well on that kind of a course layout, on where the jumps are at the flat track. And I always tell people that are intimidated by the Saratoga steeplechase season, you know, don't be. It's not a mystery.
No, that's exactly right. And that applies certainly at Saratoga because of the nature of the racetrack. It's flat. Now there's so few jumps up there. Taking out the last fence, there's two down the back now. It used to be three, so jumping is actually even less of a requirement, really, or a standard. Mm-hmm. So there, yeah, for sure. I mean, when you're handicapping Saratoga, you can take but it's definitely a factor you want to use. Is okay, who's got the most class as a flat horse? If you look at Snap Decision, yeah, he ran a 90 buyer. I mean, it's his highest buyer, and you can see when he goes to Saratoga, he wins. I mean, he's won at Saratoga and Belmont. He's actually won at Saratoga three times, won at Belmont. So he's really. And in Monmouth, I mean, he's 5-for-5 on the flat track. And he certainly is good over at the hunt meets, too. But, as a whole, you can certainly use that at Saratoga. It's a little different in a place like Nashville where, you know, it's a hunt meet, a big long hill. It's a much more of a stamina question. And you're still a little bit unproven. Once you've come to Saratoga, you maidens can't run at Saratoga. So you're looking at proven horses. You're looking at horses who have done it, have adapted, have won over jumps. So that's certainly a big factor there. Like if O'Dionysus, if he wins in Nashville, he's even more potent at Saratoga because of the flat track.
Yes.
And his back flat class.
Exactly. This is actually the first division. You're in the second division, but the first division looks interesting. And Kerry Breon, who really is trying to engage people and is encouraging people to come in on some of the horses that that she is syndicating and so forth. She's all over this card, and she's in that. Got two in the first side, and then in the fourth as well. Tell us about Queen's Empire. Bill Mott trained this Irish bred, and originally Bessie Lou actually put Crown Queen together with Empire Maker to make Queen's Empire. When did you start tracking this gelding, and tell us about his development?
Well, I started tracking him in his first start November 23rd, 2019, just on pedigree, and followed him. And then that first race was disappointing, and then didn't show up again until Ellis Park in the end of August for Maiden 10. Bill Mott with Empire Maker, Bessie Lou for Maiden 10 at Ellis Park. I thought that was pretty obvious. So he won that day. I texted Bill shortly after the race and said I was interested, and then they ran him back at Kentucky Downs at the starter, a mile and a half, and he ran an unbelievable race. Actually, he was very green, he was all over, he kind of made about five different moves and still finished third. And I texted him, I said, I'm still interested in Queen's Empire, and he wrote something back like, I guess you are. And we're like, man, he noticed what I noticed. And then he just tailed off a little. He came back and ran okay at Indiana Downs, going a mile and 3/8, and his race at Gulfstream was pretty disappointing. I think Bill actually called me after the race, which I think it was quite apparent that he had had enough of his flat career. So yeah, we put it together and bought him. You know, got on the van shortly after that race. Was, I think he was at Jack Fisher's by Christmas, and has schooled well. Wasn't quite ready to run this spring. We just kind of give him a little more time. He's only four. So he should run well, I hope. I mean, it's an acid test taking a four-year-old first-time starter to Nashville against some more experienced horses, so over a tough course. But, we like the horse. Hopefully he'll run well.
Well, the rest of this group, you got kind of a mixed bag. You got some that have been trying to break through. You've also got a couple of first-time starters, which we don't see all that often at this level. And Leslie Young's got a first North America, plenty in the tank, too. A Champs-Élysées six-year-old that has been brought to the U.S. And we'll see. We'll see who gets to graduate out of here. You've also got the Margaret Curry Henley, a minor stake as well. A couple of familiar horses that we saw as early, really earlier in the winter. Carrie Brion again, the Mean Queen that we noted. A couple of other Mrs. Steinman's got Speed Alert. Who else? Anybody else familiar?
You got Veteran Down Royal. She's cool.
Oh, yeah.
Came back for Bernie and Kate Dalton. I think they tried to retire her, actually, and that didn't work. So they brought her back, and she won a Queen's Cup first start of the year. I thought she was pretty impressive that day. Off Lasix, actually, and ran very well. The horse that beat the Mean Queen for Carrie, she won at Virginia Gold Cup, beat the boys there in a straight allowance race, but was very impressive. She's won her only two starts. Came out of a good bumper at Down Royal before she started jumping. So she's good. She's very good. Tom Garner's a good jockey. Vying for leading rider this year. So she's the horse to beat by far. She'd be, if there was betting, she'd be 3-5 probably in here.
Well, wish there was betting, but we're going to have to wait for that for Saratoga. Well, this should be a terrific afternoon, and we'll be watching along. And Sean, a couple of other topics in addition to the action, the Iroquois Saturday at Percy Warner Park, and I'll send out a link for those that are within. If you're in Louisville, if you've never been, and you're open for Saturday, drive down. Anybody within hailing distance of Nashville. What's your take on the Cheltenham conversation about adding a fifth day?
It's disappointing as always. I mean, you know, it's inevitable they're going to do it. It's money talks. I think it's disappointing that you know, it's already a behemoth, Cheltenham, and this will just make it even more of a behemoth over there. I think it's hard on a place like Uttoxeter, who has the Midlands Grand National on that Saturday. That's its traditional spot the day after Cheltenham, and it's a cool race and historic race. You know, the guy, I don't know, you know, Cheltenham takes that Saturday, and Uttoxeter takes the back seat to Cheltenham, which is what's happened over there. I mean, pretty much the whole jump season is taking a, well, it's not even a back seat. It's like the cab of the pickup truck. It's so far behind Cheltenham. I mean, it's the whole season now just centers around Cheltenham. So I'm a little disappointed. I mean, of course, if I'm there, I'll go for the 5 days and enjoy it. But I think it's disappointing that it's going to go to 5 days. There's already races now that are, you know, a lot of handicap races that aren't premier grade one type races. And you've continued to water down a product that, you know, just doesn't need water. You know, I think it's disappointing.
All right.
But I understand it. I mean, I totally get it. I understand it's why we have 40 days of racing in Saratoga and why, you know, it's why baseball's gone to playoffs and wild cards and more. You know, it's money talks. So I totally understand it. I get it. But I think it's disappointing.
I appreciate it. Appreciate the thoughts. And speaking of abroad, Ascot, did you take in?
I watched every day, pretty much every race every day, which is brilliant. It's a great race. And same thing, it's a little watered down. There's a few races now that have gone to seven races every day. And, you know, some of the races are turning just basically handicaps. But great race and great theater. It was fun to see some different people win. I thought some smaller guys won, which I thought was cool, as opposed to just the main guys dominating. And the weather was just the extremes of the weather went from firm ground the first day. I mean, I thought it was very firm. We watching Palace Pier, like, really just almost he was kind of bobbling along on the firm ground to the last day, where Friday, where it became heavy, they almost didn't race. If it wasn't Royal Ascot, they probably wouldn't have raced. I think they would have abandoned the Friday card because of it, because of the rain. So, as always, great theater and just a great spectacle.
Yeah, it was fun, and we had a couple of successes. Our man Kev provided a nice blueprint for players that would kind of blind without a cane to some degree, right? Because you just you're looking at far flung past performances and trying to decipher the going and who's going to take to it and then the fact that we really don't get to look at PPs that have got the same, pace, kinds of indicators. You can watch some of the races and some of the replays and get a sense, but, then you deal with the straight. I mean, there's so many factors, Sean, when it comes to, to particularly that stand where you're looking at some things that we just don't deal with. I mean, and I think maybe that's part of what makes it appealing.
Oh, no question. That's what makes it appealing to me. I mean, I love European racing for that reason. The different racetracks. They go left and right. They go figure eight. They go up and down hills. They have tight tracks like a place like Chester, and then they have huge expansive tracks like Sandown, and then you have to take all that and try to decipher it into. Siphon it down to make sense out of it and come up with a strategy or an opinion or a theory when it comes to a place like Royal Ascot, where it's a straight mile and they're going to split into two groups and the near side has been better than the far side, but then the middle has been different. It's just, to me, it's fascinating. I mean, if you think we think it's a complicated game here, and you're basically taking horses that are running around for all intents and purposes a mile oval every start of their lives going left-handed over there, it's just it's extraordinary, and it's fun when you get talking to your friends over there. You say, "Oh, I like this horse," and they'll say, "Oh, it's a terrible draw. You won't that draw," and you think, "Oh man, I didn't factor the draw in." So then you got to go back to the drawing board, and they're like, "Oh, he hates going right-handed. He can't win going right-handed." And you're like, "Oh God, I didn't think that all those wins were going left-handed," or that part's just fascinating to me, and that different types of ground and. It's just such it's just a captivating puzzle. I mean, really just trying to figure it out, which to me is the art of why, it's the art of horse racing. Why we like it is trying to figure out all the variables of a variable-filled game, right? We're trying to
exactly
just make sense of it. And every day you go, "Oh, my God, I didn't see that coming." And that's the beauty of it. When you get it right, you get all those variables right, and whether you own them, train them, ride them, bet on them, or you're just watching, when it all comes together and you get it right for an individual race or an individual horse, that to me is what the sport's all about, is when it comes together and you see a great champion or an individual race or performance or whether it's jumping or flat or Europe, Ireland, England, Ireland, France, America, wherever you are. That to me is what it's all about. Just trying to capture that and it's just when you see it, it's like you look at a horse like Snap Decision. Sure, he's jumping, but look at his. He's won eight in a row over all different race courses, all different jockeys, different situations, and it's jump racing. But that's the beauty of horse racing when it comes together and works out like that, and you get to stand back and watch it. It's just brilliant.
Well, there's a lot of different ways to get right to get things right in the game, and that includes from the. Bloodstock side, and before we talk a little bit about Saratoga, do a little Saratoga advance, got to ask you about this Sosua. that you bought from Mark Greer. And a Spitestown filly that was a little late getting to the races, but is now strung together. Three straight wins, is stretching out with a plum, and Arno Delacour training, was bred by China Horse. And this was this seems like there's an emerging story here.
Yeah, she's a really cool filly. We bought her at Keeneland, just a lovely kind of a little bit, I don't know, she's just kind of a little bit subdued. I just liked her. She just had a lovely kind of quiet demeanor and lovely, just a lovely type, you know, just had a great eye and a really cool way about her. And yeah, she took a while to get there. Credit to everybody involved that they're patient. Mark's patience, Arno's patience, everybody's patience to just get her there. There's nothing anything major, but just stuff they had to stop on. And she's won three in a row. Yeah, stretched out to a mile the other day. I love that race. You know, it looked like horse was running and at her. And, you know, you were just kind of watching it like, wow, is she going to get there? And when that other filly got within her, you know, kind of a, I don't know, maybe three quarters of a length or just to a length, I think within her vision, she kind of just went again, which I was impressed by that. So, yeah, cool filly. It's been fun to watch.
What other flat runners that are in competition that were coming up, two-year-olds at all?
No, I don't probably have many two-year-olds going. I bought a nice filly, Jeannie B., for CJ Thoroughbreds that won a Belmont for Mark Cassie. I like her. She's cool. Bated Breath filly. It's been fun to watch. And a few others. I got a horse named Tolfaris that runs today at Churchill for Ian Wilkes. Kind of a cool horse. So, yeah, we got a bunch. I've had a good year actually selling the horses that I bought. We won a bunch of races everywhere from Norway to, Grand National and Butler, Maryland. So it's been fun.
Well done. Well, Saratoga on the horizon, Sean, and little previewing. I'm gone vacation next week, but probably next time we talk, we'll be right on the cusp. Saratoga special staff is ready to go. When do you guys ship in?
I'll land kind of right before the meet. I mean, the meet's so long anymore that I don't get much of a run at it. I mean, I'd probably come up, guess open day's Thursday. I'll probably come up on Monday, say goodbye to my family, drive up there, and, just get back on the ride. You know, it's last year was brutal for everybody, not being able to go, and not really, you know, just such a, it's just such a disruption in our lives to not be able to go back to the place where, which we adore. So for all of us, we're excited to get up there. We're excited to get the special back going. And, just looking forward to seeing people and talking and talk racing. You know, those mornings, I always say I take the mornings over the afternoons. You know, I just miss those mornings when you're standing out there on the rail. And, back to a guy like Bill Mott rides up on the pony and you just talk horses for 10 or 15 minutes. Just that's glorious. So, yeah, we're looking forward to it. I'm just excited to get going again.
You got
like
some...
everybody. I mean, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
I think everybody
is going to be nuts.
Just, we're just jonesing for it, right?
The in terms of some of the interns and some of the young, interested parties that will do some interning this summer. You got some kids lined up?
Yeah, we've got a couple kids lined up. We'll see where they end up. We always say, look, we've had some stars come out of there, and we've also had some blow the turn, right? You know, so you never know. You never really know how it's going to go. But yeah, we've got a couple good, I think, good ones. Kid named Iv Hendricks, who's been writing for us some on our website. I think he's a very good writer. Hopefully he'll jump in, and I think he'll be a great addition, and he'll go far in the sport if he wants to. But, yeah, that's fun. I mean, that's a great part of our history is, watching, Travis Stone walk in the first day and, go out and walk out the door to go interview somebody for the first time, Gabby Galdad, and one after another, just watching those kids learn the ropes and play a role in our sport. It's we take great pride in that. It's been a very, very rewarding part of it, and long may it continue.
Well, certainly looking forward to seeing it distributed on the stands, and for those that can't get to Saratoga, reading the Saratoga special online every day makes you feel like you're here, and be looking forward to conversations with Sean and Joe and Tom Law, and maybe when we're doing some of the on-site lives, we can do some fun roundtable stuff as well. So, Sean, get lucky this weekend down at Percy Warner, and we'll see you in just a couple of weeks. We'll talk, and Saratoga will be upon us when we talk next.
Thanks for having me on the show. Thanks again for everything you do for the sport. It's a great dedication, and sport's better for it. So thank you, and look forward to seeing you Saratoga.
I got final question. How did the Little League team end up?
Oh man, it was brutal. We're the worst team in the league, but everybody makes the playoffs. So we played the Orioles, the dreaded Orioles, who had slaughter ruled us twice during the season. I mean, they got 10 runs up on us, and they can't. One game where our last batter didn't even get the bat against the Orioles. That's how bad it was. I mean, it was awful. And so we had to play them in the playoffs, and we battled hard. Miles pitched two scoreless innings, and we battled back. We were down 4-3, and Miles was on second base, two outs, and our leadoff hitter Cole hit a little shot to center field, and Coach Chris sent Miles around third, and he slid into home, and some kid named, he looked like Willie Mays, threw it from center field, and just a laser, and nailed Miles at the plate, and for the final out, Miles' final Little League game. I had some tears. Miles had a few, he was stifling tears, and Dad was stifling tears, and it was brutal. It was beautiful and brutal all at the same time. It was it was tough. It's just been to anybody who's been through, any parent who's been through Little League, or any parent who's going to or thinking about having their kid play baseball, I mean, it's just it's been, as Little League was absolutely the best experience maybe of my life, just spending those days with Miles. And baseball is such a surreal game. It has that quietness, and you have that time to talk and reflect and think about the game, and it's just been a very, very special time of our lives. That's something that I will never, ever forget, and I just it was a very, very special special time, special game, and it was tough.
It sounds like there's a column in this.
Yeah, I wrote one, and I'll probably write another one. But yeah, I wrote one on our website. You're not reading my stuff. Come on, man.
I'll go back and look. Jesus, you're killing me. Is your coaching career over?
You're not coming to Nashville. You're not reading my stuff. I mean, I don't know what the heck you're doing, man. You get off of Twitter and start.
I'm happy. That'd be my pleasure.
The world, man.
is your baseball coaching career come to an end now too?
Well, I mean, I was always lucky. I was very smart. I took the assistant coach's role, which is the perfect role because you're actually not out there as Coach Chris sending Miles Clancy round and third with the game on the line. So if Miles keeps playing, I mean, I got to find him something. I think there's like Babe Ruth and league, or maybe a middle school team or something. So I got to look into that if he can keep playing. But I'd certainly, I like that role as assistant coach. I know very little. I know the rules of baseball. That's about it. I don't know any real skills. So, as I say, I'm there for team morale. That's what I'm there for. I'm very good at that.
You're a good shoulder to cry on.
I heard one of the other coaches say to somebody in the crowd after kind of a game or something, and he said, "Yeah, he's the rah rah guy." Yeah, that's me. I'm the rah rah guy.
That's you, Mr. Rah Rah.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. Well, I'm glad it provided uplift and distraction for you this spring, and more pleasure than some of the other things that occupy our time. And now we can focus on Saratoga. And Sean, thanks so much, and get lucky this weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Sean Clancy, everybody, and you follow Sean by Sean Clancy on Twitter, and of course Saratoga Special and Joe Clancy as well, and Saratoga TL, Saratoga Tom Law, the thisishorseracing.com team. Saratoga Special starts opening day and not far off. In fact, what do we got? Today's the 24th, so it's what, 1, 2, 3 weeks from today. Holy cow. I promised you another visit with Chris Hyde and animal lobbyists and the emerging opportunity for members of the industry to support the legislation that very well could spell the difference for ending slaughter and keeping horses out of harm's way. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Steve. I appreciate it.
Not at all. You kind of hinted in our last visit that there was going to potentially be a landmark opportunity to support legislation, and now it's at hand. And we want to explain what the process is, where it stands. I mentioned earlier this morning, there was good news, it seems, from the bipartisan Senate team that is negotiating the infrastructure bill, which this might get tacked onto or will get tacked onto. So whatever it takes from racing stakeholders and horse players and fans, if we can influence this, we need to know how.
Well, no, I appreciate that. You're exactly right. We've always thought in this process of trying to ban slaughter, you have to look for every kind of vehicle that moves through Congress. There's the standalone bill, there's appropriations, there's the surface transportation, and that kind of, you're right, this presented itself. They have to reauthorize this legislation every 5 years. And it's usually $1 trillion, and it deals with highways and trains and all that kind of stuff. But they do it every 5 years. So they have been working on this one for a while to get together. And we just thought it was kind of the perfect opportunity. We worked closely with Congressman Troy Carter from Louisiana. He's been a really vocal activist in Congress for trying to end horse slaughter. He's joined by a couple of other Republicans and Democrats on this amendment. And it's very straightforward. What it will do is to ban the transportation of horses for slaughter within the United States. So you wouldn't be able to move a horse on any of the highways if that horse is intended for slaughter. So that would also keep them from going out of the United States, because that would be the same purpose. So this was kind of really the perfect opportunity that presented itself. The chairman of the committee has always been a supporter of ending slaughter. And as I said, we've got a good group with this. So I think early next week, they are hoping to start consideration of this bill. It's called the Invest Act in America, or Invest in America Act, and they are hoping to start considering it on the House floor as early as next week. And so that's where we will have this amendment I mentioned. It will be brought up and considered on the House floor and hopefully approved to be included in the final package when they wrap that up. So it's coming up very quick. And we're, as you said, very excited about the opportunity to do this, because it could finally Shut everything down after almost 20 years of fighting on this issue.
A couple of T crossing and I dotting to discuss. Explain the thing that I retweeted last night, which is on the website, the Return to Freedom organization, the Wild Horse Conservation team, and the core element, as I tweeted last night, to call your representative. We'll explain that in a minute, but it's urging them to vote yes on Amendment 187, which pertains to slaughter, no on Amendment 184, the double-decker trailers, and to then to support overall the INVEST Act, which is House Resolution 3684. Explain the yes portion on the slaughter and the no on the transport.
Absolutely. No, that's great. Yes, you have three amendments that were offered. One is the one I mentioned by Mr. Carter that would end horse slaughter, would ban the transportation of horses to slaughter. We are having to offer that amendment. So that's what's going to be voted on next week, is that one. And once that's approved, then that will be included in the overall bill. The second amendment you mentioned is by a Congressman, Dusty Johnson. And what he tries to do is, there's already language in the INVEST Act that prohibits the use of double-deck trailers. That's one level on top of the other for hauling horses in the United States. It's kind of an odd issue, is that almost 20 years ago, the U.S. Congress passed a law requiring the prohibition of using double-deck horse trailers for hauling horses to slaughter, because they realized it was too cruel and these are very dangerous, so we've had a horrible accident. So the committee included language kind of closing that loophole and saying you can't haul any horse anywhere in the United States on a trailer that has one level on top of the other. So that's actually already in the bill. What Congressman Johnson is trying to do is to strip that language out. There's no logic to doing it because these trailers are extremely dangerous. People claim they don't use them. But he is trying to strip that good language out. And if he strips that language out, it's actually attached to where the horse slaughter language would go. So he could be messing with both provisions. So that's why we're encouraging, and again, you can get it on returntofreedom.org, everybody to call their legislators and to tell them to support, vote yes on the Carter Fitzpatrick horse slaughter ban amendment and no on the Dusty Johnson double-decker amendment, because they can interchange and impact each other, and they're both very important for the welfare of horses. So those are kind of the two votes that will be happening sometime next week.
The 800 number that we're featuring, the 202, as opposed to the 800, the 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121, and I'll retweet all this again. How does that system work in terms of connecting individuals to their respective representative?
No, that's a perfect question. Usually we will also provide emails. We'll give you a link and you can send an email to your legislator.
Right.
Because this is going so quickly, we included that number. And what that number is, it's the Capitol switchboard. So you will get an operator at the U.S. Capitol, and they'll ask you what you want, and you'll say, I'd like to be connected to my legislator. And if you don't know your legislator, they'll ask you a zip code. And they'll find your legislator for you and transfer you to the legislator's office, or you can hopefully get a human directly. Because of COVID, a lot of offices still aren't in practice, but their phone lines are set up. And you can leave a message, and certainly stating your position, that you're a constituent, and state your positions on both of these issues. And if you want to leave your address, you can actually ask for a follow-up on how they were and what they did on this issue. When it comes up, but that's all depending on the person. Of course, if you have more time, I would also encourage you to go to just congress.gov, and you can find a link to your legislator's website, and you can send them an email through their website if you have some extra time to do that quickly. So that's kind of a second option. Or tweet them on social media as well to raise profile of this. So just get the voice out and let them all know the importance of this, and that you're a constituent. This is how you vote, and this is very important to you, because these opportunities don't come along very often.
Is there a pre-written email that as well that people can utilize?
One yet because of the time frame, but actually I will work with Return to Freedom to put one on their website when you go to that page, and you'll find it on their homepage. If you go to returntofreedom.org, I can put up a little kind of an outline message for people to say what that will help them. But if you just want to call, you can just call and tell them you support those two things. So we'll set up both options for everybody.
Well, and what I'm going to do, I went to house.gov and have got the page where you just simply type in your zip.
Yeah.
And if you're unsure, I'm all too familiar with our representative here in upstate New York. For those that that might be unsure, Chris, also explain the procedurals that the timing. You mentioned the first thing will be on voting on the amendments. What would the potential timeline be, and the various steps? You can do a little afternoon, ABC afternoon special here. You're just the bill.
Yeah, it's very hard to predict legislation. I always kind of compare it to being a shortstop in baseball. Somebody's always swinging at your head. With this one, we're going to start hopefully voting on this. Their intention is to start voting on these amendments on the floor early next week. And usually that process to pass the whole bill with amendments and debate can take about 2 days. So hopefully by the end of the week, the House will have voted on this full package. I assume it's going to be very partisan. Because out of committee, I think all of the Republicans opposed the bill and the Democrats approved it, so it passed. I assume that's going to be very similar to this bill when it reaches the House floor. Thankfully, that is not always true on amendments. Amendments tend to be still very bipartisan depending on the issue that people like. And this amendment, as I mentioned, has Republicans and Democrats on it. So the House should hopefully have this wrapped up later this week. And it's great, as you mentioned. The Senate has just made news that the Senate has reached a bipartisan agreement. At least a core group of Republicans and Democrats have reached a bipartisan effort that looks like the White House is willing to accept. So they will probably try to take that bill up rather quickly. And once they do, they're going to merge those two bills together. It's kind of like a conference committee, and they work the two differences out between the bills, and they come up with one final bill that then is presented. They each vote on that final bill. And then it is sent to the president for his signature. As it's looking now, there is going to be certainly a difference between the House and the Senate. The Senate was a compromise. The House was very partisan. So we'll see how long it takes them to work out the differences between those two bills. But because this is a priority to the new Democratic president, my assumption is they're going to try to move very quickly. So this could all happen, within up to early July, hopefully. With all of this. So we'll see how fast things roll and how the Senate agreement is reached. But it's all actually looking very good so far this year.
Well, as I'm listening, putting together the tweet with the link with the Find Your Representative zip code finder, and that'll help you along in this process. And how has the initiative, how has it changed, and what makes this this version and this moment, feel like it's finally at hand, as opposed to, the previous incantations.
Well, yeah, we've looked at this language before in doing it in the Transportation Committee, and as I said, sadly, so few opportunities present itself on trying to get legislation passed. It doesn't happen as often as a lot of people think, unless it's kind of a big sweeping bill. And this is one of those big sweeping bills. Usually every Congress has a couple. In order to move things on those bills, they kind of, in terms of germane, it has to be related to the bill that is moving. So thankfully, our issue happens to relate to this bill. Another big one is called the Farm Bill, and that's coming up in 2 years that we could have attempted to do. I think what's so exciting is you get so few opportunities at anything, even a hearing or any kind of vote. So when you have the opportunity like this, is that when you've got the committee chairs behind it, and you always have the support to do it, and there's an actual opportunity to be heard. We've always said all we need is a fair chance on the floor. We've always got the votes. and this can be our fair chance on the House floor to actually getting a vote. And that's the big difference. It's not just getting co-sponsors. It's actually getting a vote on something that we've been working for decades. That's the big change.
When did you first get engaged in this effort?
And this actually back in 2001, early 2001, I went with a friend up to New Holland Livestock Auction, and that's the big one up in or outside of Philadelphia. So actually, a lot of horses off the tracks used to come up and into New Holland because that was kind of the big one on the East Coast. And at that time, nobody knew about this. Some friend told me that, look at that pen in the back. It's, you know, there were racehorses that had been drugged, you know, because they'd been injured, so they just wanted to sedate them. And there's, you know, quarter horses and kind of in this back pen. And that's when I started asking around about it and learned that horse slaughter was still taking place, right under our nose. So we just started building it up. And I got the late John Hettinger, who was with the New York Racing Association, and Daisy Tipton. He was one of my first supporters and worked tirelessly with me for up until his passing. So it's been a long thing, and a lot of great people, you know, that we've met along the way. And so hopefully this is our chance. And we really need the racing industry. I mean, that's why I wanted to reach out to you. We've got the humane community. We've got the rescue community. If we could get the racing community to really step up, if we could get NYRA or NTRA or Breeders' Cup or Jockey Club, anybody who starts sending letters right now, anybody's listening, that would be, a huge plus to show that we've got, industry and welfare and the public behind this thing. So that's what I'm hoping for.
Chris Hyde is with us, Animal Lobbyists on Twitter, and we've had these conversations leading up to what really appears to be a legitimate scoring opportunity to make it impossible for horses to leave the borders, either north to the abattoir or south to the slaughter plants in Mexico. And this, this is a topic, Chris. In fact, you've written articles or blog entries about it. And I suppose that as part of this discussion, it's important to, have a cogent approach and, and a comprehensive plan for a landing place for, the horses. We, as having thoroughbred interest, I mean, we hope we answer to the thoroughbred side. Thoroughbreds are a smaller percentage, quite honestly, of horses that leave the country for slaughter. I mean, it seems that the spotlight gets trained on the thoroughbred community because we're, higher profile. But the quarters, there's a lot of quarter horses that are involved in this. What is our, what is the back end? What do we do in terms of making sure there's something responsible to be done with the horses that would no longer, leave the borders?
Well, I really appreciate you bringing that up because that is a key thing. I think, certainly I'll take me, somebody's coming outside of the horse industry, even though now I've kind of been intermingled with it for about 20 years, I would always say to John, you have to sell to the public what they see of horses in the United States. It's either the ones roaming in the West or it's a thoroughbred at the Kentucky Derby. They know the Triple Crown. They probably can't name the other two, but they know Kentucky Derby, within this. So that's the perception that you're trying to sell. So you're right. Quarter horses, I think, are 75% plus going to slaughter versus thoroughbreds maybe. I think it used to be about 16 to 17%. And I believe that was the number back when we started this effort. So I know it's much smaller than that because, the industry, I would give them great credit, has put, effort into aftercare and issues like that, which has been great. I can't say the other, only the other industries have been that proactive, but I think overall, horse welfare has improved dramatically within these things. So, yeah, I think that, as you noted, it is important to realize that there are other horses involved in this. It's a bigger issue, and that once we end this, you know, there is a network for these. We are paying attention to welfare. We're paying attention to breeding or overbreeding, or, you know, that it's also a responsibility. I just talked to an owner yesterday, you know, who got involved in this because when he bought some horses recently, he had to fill out kind of an electronic form, you know, saying he wanted to be contacted if there's a sale of his horse down the road to kind of keep that chain. And he liked that. You know, and I said that didn't exist, you know, when John and I were first doing this 20 years ago. So, you know, he was pleased that we're making all these steps. But I think it'll be very easy to transition once we end slaughter, because it's a business. So slaughter's there, they're dumping them because there's the opportunity. But if the opportunity's not there, these horses will either have not been bred or, you know, be able to find good homes. And there's plenty of those around the United States. So very hopeful.
Well, that could be a challenge that everyone would be happy, would be an obligation that, frankly, everybody would be happy to have to commit to.
Absolutely. That's the intention. I think if people know it, you know, they want to do the right thing, you know, and I think that's, you just have those opportunities. If you know there's rescues out there, if you know there's these, you know, extra homes that are safe, people want to do the right thing, and I think we're ready for that.
The opportunity to get behind this initiative, the Invest Act, and for everybody in the thoroughbred community to respond. And I can equate this effort to the NTRA initiative that took years and years to make happen, which was adjustment of the gambling winnings taxation system, and it took a gear shift essentially to simplify it. And when a comment period was open and the window, and it was important for all of us as players and even people who weren't necessarily horse players, a chance to help the industry by getting the Treasury Department to address the structure of the taxation, people responded enthusiastically, and it was a major part of the ultimate change in the way the rules were written. And it's been a huge benefit. I mean, the estimate was that it could enhance handle by 6 or 7%. It only took, in that case, from the, if I'm not mistaken, the number was 12,000 emails to legislators, or to the, not the legislators, but to the Treasury Department. Chris, in this case, and in lobbying initiatives of this ilk, what is a critical mass? What influences? What kind of a number per legislator does it take to, you know, to push the peanut?
Yeah, that's tough. It's tough for animal issues. You know, we've always grappled with that because the one strength from kind of the animal welfare movement perspective, which is what I come from, you know, we're phenomenally good at generating emails. One of the last times we had a vote on the bill to ban slaughter was back when Katrina hit in Louisiana. It was one right after that that hit Houston. So we were right in that window. Chief Justice Roberts was being considered for that position. We generated more phone calls to Capitol Hill and to every office that we talked to, except for one, on the horse slaughter vote over Katrina and over a Supreme Court nomination. So we're phenomenal at generating it. I think what the animal movement and animal issues like this need, though, is just that kind of public awareness, getting out and reaching outside of just the traditional animal movement. You know, once they start hearing from, you know, owners and tracks and, you know, donors and things like that, then that level will be raised. But I think, you know, certainly if we can continue to just flood them with thousands over the next week, of emails and phone calls, that will give their attention, because their attention is on this Invest Act. So we're just kind of fine-tuning it to highlight one of these issues. And I think once they pair that with the fact that this issue has been bipartisan, it has passed Congress before, and it's time to end it. I think that's kind of a perfect storm right now. So the numbers, the timing, the history, the opportunity is just it's that perfect opportunity for us.
Well, so I bring that up because this is really the kind of thing where those of you listening that have whatever communication vehicle you can use, social media, ideally, community pages. I actually recently joined a Facebook thing that is our is Greenwich, just right here in Washington County, and it's actually invaluable for hearing about just local topics even things like garbage collection on holidays, when there's a schedule change. I mean, you'd be amazed, actually. There is one of these weekly kinds of, not penny saver, but, anybody that lives in a rural community is aware of that. But as it happens, a place like that, like a Facebook community page or family pages, just your regular page. I mean, if you can communicate to friends of yours and family members that are not plugged into racing, this is a time to call in some favors, and it's not a big ask either. I mean, get all the information, gather, take the phone number and I gave you your link to find your representative, and ask your, ask friends and family to do this, to make this call. And the, the staffers in the various offices, and actually you never know when your actual congressman or congresswoman picks up the phone in the office, mm-hmm. because that does happen. This is the opportunity, and Chris has explained to you that he's been working at this himself for 20 years, and mm-hmm. there's never been a better opportunity.
No, I think it's key. Certainly, what's nice reaching out to, your listeners with this, I think it's so important, is to reach outside of the welfare community. That's great, and I think a lot of people support it, and a lot of people donate to charities, but we've been kind of insular in dealing with a segment, and that's what its hope is, to reach out to your listeners, who may know about this, at least on some passing or not at all, and then, as you said, they tell their friends. You never know. I mean, it was always funny who John Hediger could, he would call me and he'd say, "I've got Congressman so-and-so on the phone. I've known him for years. You want to talk?" And I'm like, you never know who those connections can be. So certainly anybody listening, if you know members of Congress or family or anything like that as well, which is, not uncommon for a representative in a community, you can let me know, through social media and contact me, or, I'm happy to do that, or just give them a call and urge them to support the bill. The gentleman yesterday who told me about buying the recent horses, he's already talked to three legislators he knows personally.
Wow. So,
that kind of stuff is a huge, huge help, in taking it right to the source. So any opportunity we can get, we will take.
Well, Chris Hyde, I appreciate this, and I've pressed on and kept the conversation going because I want to catch as many people listening that tune in as possible. And I'm on vacation next week, so I won't be able to provide live updates. But certainly via if you keep me advised, I can tweet freely, and we'll keep recirculating what I just tweeted out there. So I really you can't imagine how big of an opportunity this is for us all as an industry to put an end. If we shut this off and close down this pipeline, it benefits the horses, obviously, first and foremost, and keeps them out of a terrifying pipeline. But it also, frankly, reflects well on us as caretakers and as, you know, the voice, the active voice for the equine athlete, and you know, the ones, you know, the mares that you know, have stopped producing, and you know, the horses that can't compete and don't have a you know, an obvious second career at hand, and even the ones that just get caught up inadvertently that absolutely could have a second career if given the opportunity. So this is our chance as people that talk the talk. Now you got a chance to walk the walk and stop this. And there may not be a better chance if this one isn't taken advantage of.
No, absolutely. And this is, you know, it's an easy thing for anybody. As you said, it's good for the animals. But, I mean, you know, those that get behind it, I hate saying it, it's a freebie. It's one of those things that you can do something so good, it really has no negative impact, you know, on anything. Because this has always been a drag on, it's been a drag on racing. It's been a drag on any of the horse industry. It was a drag on the welfare community because we didn't pay attention to equine welfare, you know, kind of until this issue came up. So I think, you know, for everybody, this is a really great opportunity to do something big, you know, that will allow us to then focus on other things, to increase adoption, increase homes, and second careers and training, and all of those kinds of things. So you're right, it's a huge opportunity for us, and we need to grab it as hard as we can and get this thing done. So I'm very excited and very positive, but it's tough. Congress is not an easy place to do things, so it's still going to be a fight. You know, I think it's all on our side. We've got the votes, we've got the support. We just need to, you know, kind of increase public outcry right now to get this thing wrapped up. And that's what I'm hoping for.
Now, Chris, I can't thank you enough. Animal Lobbyists is Chris's Twitter address, and you're going to be seeing it the next several days. And even while I'm away, I'll be sure to act as a conduit for more information and the urging on a daily basis for everybody to get in contact with your congressman and get your friends and family to do it as well, because I think we can really make a difference here and what is just a heinous blight on equine sport and equine interests, which then is all of our interests. So, Chris, thank you so much.
Well, Steve, I appreciate it, and I'll keep Twitter updated, so anybody needs to know anything, it'll be there as fast as I know it. So, again, I appreciate you taking the time to have me on and talk about this and all of your awareness. And it's all positive, and that's the beauty of this. Everything we're doing is positive for the horse and certainly for racing. It's a great step forward, so I appreciate it.
Not at all. It's an obligation, and I'm happy to, you know, to act as a conduit. Chris Hyde, everybody, and we will keep you apprised, and then hopefully when we come back vacation, we'll have, you know, really good news and you know, more progress to report. We're going to stay right here. We got about 15 minutes to close out on the Thursday edition at the races, and as Tony Black joins us, I've got some really sad news that I just came across. Mike Dempsey tweeted, I guess, in the last half hour, word that Rich Glazier has passed away in Delaware. And Rich has been, I mean, the personality and, you know, the voice. I mean, John Curran was the voice that you heard calling races at Delaware, but the face and personality was Rich Glazier, and a wonderful, wonderful guy who loved the game, who was fun and funny and smart. And we knew, you know, we've told you the last year and a half or so that, you know, we knew he had not been well. And I didn't realize that it was, you know, that it was this dire, and I just can't say enough nice things to honor Rich Glazier. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Yes, sad news. You know, I knew he had health issues. He was the paddock personality, and when you walked out in that paddock with those colors on, don't be surprised if he just walked up to you and started talking about the race that you're ready to compete in and knew what he was talking about and asked you questions that were really right on the money about the horse you were riding or your competition. You know, it's so refreshing when you can talk to somebody that's doing a commentary or in that position of doing commentary, and they're not just commentators, they know the sport. You know, this is a unique sport. It's not an everyday sport. It's not something that people have knowledge of on a daily basis. And when you can talk to somebody that talks to you as a horseman, that was Rick Glazier. He talked to you like he was, and I know he never rode a race. He was a big man. I know he couldn't have ridden a race. But he talked to you like he understood what it was to be a jockey, what it was to be a trainer. He was absolutely the voice of the paddock and a paddock personality, and will sorely be missed. You know, he brought light to the racing in general. He was a good guy to be around, and will be missed.
Hey,
now, on another note,
yeah,
definitely are going to be making phone calls when it comes to supporting anything that has to do with eliminating horse slaughter and this legislation that's in the works. And I'm going to take it to the jocks room, the numbers that you put up, and tell these jocks and pet parks, you know, make some phone calls, get off your butt and do something that promotes the sport. And it sells what needs to be sold to the public, that we are compassionate people that care about what we do and the animals that we compete with. So we're definitely going to make some headway in getting people in racing interested in doing something that's very important, you know, protect these animals. And I got another one I got to go into. You know, you usually give me my podium where I can make
sure.
And I listen, I don't want to throw this one at you, blindside you, but it was brought to my attention because of the passing of my uncle, and one person that in particular came to the celebration of his life, and she really impressed me, and we got to talking, Kathy Passmore.
Yeah.
We were talking about my uncle, and she knows the Bonitas family and, of course, the Black family, and I knew those kids when they were growing up in Merle and her sisters, and we were reminiscing about stories and funny stories that we had that are the things that she remembered, because she's a sweet, sweet girl. Yeah, she has a great memory. Then we got to talking about her dad, William Passmore Jr. And, you know, his father was a jump rider. And when you were talking to Sean Clancy, I was thinking, man, these jump riders, they're a special breed. You know, I remember Brian Hickey, Joe Agius, and Jerry Fishback, and these guys, they're a special breed. I remember when Hardtack rode a jump race to prove that he could do it. Well, I didn't see him do it more than once. You know, these up and overs aren't easy to deal with, these jumping races. But we were talking about her dad and how his career paralleled the career of my uncle. And my uncle's in the National Horse Racing Hall of Fame. You know, and he never won a Derby Preakness Belmont, but he was a mainstay rider in the state of New Jersey and in Florida. He was a pillar of the turf. That's what you'd be considered. And her father, when I rode in Maryland, you couldn't consider anybody more than pillar of the turf. You know, he rode for 38 years, won over 3,500 races, and was a racing official for 20 years till his passing. And he was a mentor, knowingly and unknowingly, to guys like Chris McCarron, Kent DeZarmo, and riders that went down to Merlin or started their career in Merlin. Like Chris didn't. What was it, 74 or 5, whatever his career started, I remember. I remember Chris starting his career at Bowie and winning one of his first races because it was a horse I was riding and got taken off of him. They put the bug on and Chris won on him. So I remember that horse, Chipachi. But anyway, Bill Passmore was a rider that people watched because not just as a writer, but as a family man. He exhumed respect, credibility, integrity as a writer, but also as a family man. Stayed in Maryland and wrote because he had a wife and kids, and it was a great area to raise your family without having to travel all over the country. But I thought to myself, as I did one other time bring up a name, My Juliet, as a horse that possibly was, you know, could be considered, maybe, just maybe, if we get to looking into it, and Mr. Haskin and you look into it, possibly Bill Passmore Jr. could be someone who would maybe be considered as a future inductee into the Racing Hall of Fame. I mean, it's a great honor if he ever we ever did accomplish it. He's not here.
Sure.
So I'm sure he's up there to appreciate it. If you believe in up there, he's up there and he would appreciate it. But you know what? His family would appreciate it, and it's deserving, because he exhumed, like I said, respect, credibility, integrity, but not just as a writer, but also as a family man. And maybe we can start something, and people, right people, will look into his career. Like I said, he wrote 38 years, was a steward for 20 years, and won over 3,500 races. But more importantly, a lot of people watched what he did and tried to copy his, not style of riding, but just him in general. And I'll tell you one thing he taught me real quick. He taught me the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, because I can remember on many occasions in the latter stages of a race going past him, and he was a sly fox. You'd go past him, right? You get that. And when riders pass a rider, like at the 16th pole or the 8th pole or in the latter stages of the race, you get that thrill. You know you're going to win it. And you'd get that thrill that I'm going to win this race. I just went past the horse that's been on the lead. And you'd get to the wire, and that same horse would come back and beat you. So you got the thrill of victory for a few seconds, you know, a few strides. And then all of a sudden you realize the reality of the agony of defeat. And he did that to so many riders so many times. And I'll never forget the times that he did it to me. I can't remember the horses' names because I probably wanted to forget them, because who wants to remember something you thought you were going to win on and you got beat in the later stages of the race? But maybe somebody can look into his career and see that he might be a consideration as a future inductee. Don't know, but I certainly wanted to mention it.
And why not? You know, it's... I suppose that Passmore fits a category, Tony, that I don't want to call it limited exposure, but not, you know, it didn't necessarily have a career of volume, if you understand. You know, one of the things that seems to be holding back David Whiteley from election is that he didn't have this prolific career, or that he didn't, train, you know, big strings of horses for, you know, for an extended period, you know, essentially amassing numbers. And Passmore, I think, has got, you know, kind of a more of a limited resume, that I imagine. It feels like he may have fallen into a, you know, kind of a black hole when it came to, you know, the process of being considered, and even I'm not even sure if he, you know, the voting process where he fit in terms of timing.
Right, but I know he rode like for 38 years and won over 3,500 races.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and he was a steward for 20 years, and you just think that someone that can be a major influence in the sport at a area that he was in that area because of his family and because, you know, he didn't travel out and didn't maybe have all the big horses to go follow around, but rode a many a nice horse. But you wonder if just because of his influence in racing in that area and what he brought to the table, you know, like I said, credibility, respect, integrity, and mentored a many a young rider and riders that were highly successful. I mean, Chris McCarron, you know, and they used him as an example. When he was riding in his 70s, Bill had been riding since 48. You know, so he was an old rider that you watched. And And maybe it'll go someplace, and maybe not. But I had to bring it up because the more I thought about it, I thought about, here, my uncle's in the National Hall of Fame, and he rode in the 48, and he rode like 19 years. You know, never won a Triple Crown race, but rode nice horses, and he was a mainstay rider and an influence in Jersey and rode in Florida in the wintertime, but stayed in this area most of the year because my uncle's family lived right around the corner from me. And the only time they would go to, and then when racing closed at Garden State in the fall, he would go to Florida for a few months. And you know what? He'd take the kids out of school, and he would take them to Florida for a few months, and then they would finish school in Florida, and then they would start school back up in the fall in Jersey. You know, and so it was, he did travel a little bit, but it was only between Jersey and Florida. But Passmore, one thing about it, you could stay in Maryland and be at Laurel Buoy Pimlico and race year-round and never be within more than driving distance of any one of the racetracks. And he had the girls and his wife and him, you know, stayed married and raised the daughters, which that has to be a heck of a job, raising the girls. I think that must be harder than raising boys, unless your boy's name was Tony Black. That might have been a tough job.
Well, you know, and you know, just kind of, I just wanted to look and see, you know, some of his biggest wins, and you can see that the Pennsylvania, Maryland, when it comes to the graded stakes, but you know, the guy actually, the one of the people that one of the trainers that he rode for regularly and later in his career was King Leatherberry. And King, you know, King got into the hall without without the benefit of countless graded stake wins. You know, he might be a very good kind of parallel, actually.
And some of the, you know, some of the stakes he won weren't graded at the time. Like, he won the Pennsylvania Derby in 83. He won the John B. Campbell in 72. I did some research.
Nice.
I don't want to use your show as a personal platform.
No, it's fine.
You think. But, you know, I mean, he won the Woodlawn Stakes, the Top Flight Handicap, wrote some of the, you know, Dixieland Band, Cure the Blues, horses of that caliber, you know, and won some major stakes on him. Like you say, maybe some of these races, these stakes weren't graded at the time, but eventually were. And maybe he wasn't a guy that traveled to New York and all over the countryside in California, you know. But he rode 38 years, and his reputation was as important as his performance on the racetrack. And like I said, won over 3,500 races. But I had to bring it up, you know, because I was just, it just got my attention when I was talking to people and we were at my uncle's
nice
celebration.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I know I'm running out of time and I don't want to step on your time frame, but I really appreciate you letting me bring this to the table.
Of course. That's what you're here for. That's why we talk to you every week. We won't talk to you next week, though, Tony.
All right.
Vacation.
You enjoy, and I'm going to get up to Saratoga this year too.
All right, nice, nice.
Love you, brother. Keep up.
Love you too. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
We'll, you know, tomorrow we've got a lot to do. It's weekend preview, and there's a lot of good racing. And then I'm going to be gone a week, but we certainly have got to get a couple of people in to pay tribute to Rich Glaser. I am really that it's heartbreaking. I feel terrible that I got to deliver that news. Well, thanks, though, to Tony, Sean Clancy with a terrific visit, and Dick Powell earlier, but most importantly, Chris Hyde with the opportunity for all of us to band together and put an end to the path for horse slaughter. And we'll keep that pressure up. Good luck if you're playing today. Plenty of action. Churchill and Belmont and much, much more. And tomorrow, 9 o'clock, weekend preview as we wrap up the first half of the broadcast year here on At the Races, Sirius XM. Thanks, everybody.
summertime song. Fall on the apple. Oh, there goes a Buick 49, black sheep of the angels riding, riding down the line. We think there is a soul. We don't know.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Horse players, the Southern California Daytime Thoroughbred Racing Circuit is back at Los Alamitos Racecourse for our exciting summer meet. Opening day is Friday, June 25th, and will run through Monday, July 5th. First post is 1 p.m. Pacific, and as always, exciting racing action is ahead. Our opening weekend features the Bertrando Stakes on Saturday, June 26th, followed by a great 4th of July weekend of racing. On Saturday, July 3rd, the Los Alamitos Derby heads the marquee. Past winners of this race include Eclipse Award winners, Accelerate, Shared Belief, Game Winner, and more. On Sunday, July 4th, Los Alamitos will host a live money handicapping contest with two berths to the 2022 NHC up for grabs. And on closing day, Monday, July 5th, the racing action will be headed by the Great Lady M Stakes. Horse players, remember that Los Alamitos features a traditional $2 pick six with a 70-30 split. This summer, exciting daytime thoroughbred racing is back at Los Alamitos Racecourse. For more, visit losalamitos.com.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's Live Foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com.